But I'd like to introduce a speaker who I think has a really fascinating story. Matter of fact, I'd love to be able to tell a story, but then I'd be stealing from what he's going to be doing, so I'm going to not do that. But he has been, Grandpa has been with the Oregonian for 15 years. He's a food writer. He's arts and entertainment. He's done really fantastic articles, which I really have to thank him for, about some of the subjects that we're talking about here. As he said, he is a Northwest Veg member now. And I'm not going to tell you his story because he does such a fascinating job doing it. So without further ado, Grant.
Well, thank you all for being here. This has been a really amazing day. It started out this morning bright and early down on the waterfront with Race for the Cure, which is such an exciting and beautiful experience. I did the 5K walk and I finished in 55 minutes, which is not bad for a guy with really short legs and a small stride, so I felt pretty good about that. And then, of course, the day culminates with this, a chance to speak at this event, which is very dear to me for reasons you'll hear. I have a little short presentation for you all, no bells and whistles or anything like that, just me up here talking and sharing with you. And then we'll have plenty of time for discourse. I want to have plenty of time to answer your questions and hopefully answer them in a humorous way. So, but first, I want to tell you a little bit about a fellow named Tim O'Shea. He is a columnist for the Monitor newspaper in Concord, New Hampshire. And just recently, he embarked on a vegan eating experience that lasted for a whopping 2 weeks. Now, before Tim O'Shea decided to go on his vegan experiment, he didn't do much in the way of preparation. He bought himself a vegan cookbook and then didn't bother looking at it. He didn't really bother to go to the grocery store and buy any products that might help him on his way. So then on day one, he opened up his pantry and realized there wasn't really anything for him to eat. And he started 2 weeks of more or less nonstop complaining about all the things that he saw wrong with vegan eating. Black coffee? Ooh, that's vile stuff. A vegan waffle? That's like eating burlap. A black bean burger from a restaurant? The, quote, bastardization of the American meal. Vegans, he contends, eat nothing but a diet of twigs, rice cakes, and apricots. After 1 week, at a dinner party that he held at his own home, he served his guests chicken wrapped with prosciutto and pasta with a sauce that had ham and bacon in it. And then when he sat down at the table, he looked around and realized that he didn't have anything to eat except cucumbers and bread. Well, he gorged himself on chicken and pork. You can kind of see where this is going. Then he took a trip to New York City. And I'm told that in New York City, I haven't been there since I became a vegan, but I'm told that if you do a Google search, you can find all sorts of vegan and vegetarian options there. It's a really great city, I'm told, to eat vegan. But he didn't do that. And instead, he had his vegan experience really fall off the rails, and I'm quoting him here. All the willpower in the world faded as my environment surrounded me, he writes. I'd like to tell you I was pure, the pinnacle of principled veganism, but after that bagel with cream cheese, the steak slathered in garlic butter, the turkey BLT with mayo, the bucket of beef brisket nachos, and 3 pieces of classic New York pizza, I'd only be fooling myself. Yet I dare any vegan among us who's claimed to resist such temptation to cast the first fiddlehead. Well, Tim, consider it cast. It's pretty clear that Tim O'Shea made up his mind about the merits of vegan eating long before he began his sad experiment. With such a cynical approach, he was destined to fail. And frankly, I feel sorry for the guy. He had a golden opportunity as an inquisitive journalist to stretch his legs and find out more about the world around him and maybe discover that something that he didn't know something about might be okay. I know because I've been there. Almost 2 years ago, I embarked on a similar journalistic stunt, and I had a very different end to the experience. It ended up changing my life. Now, before we get there, to understand where I'm at, you need to know a little bit about where I'm coming from. I grew up in Kansas City, which a century ago had some of the largest stockyards in the United States, and where beef is very much a part still of the civic identity there. When you are in Kansas City, you start to notice that there are steakhouses and barbecue joints all over the place, kind of the way coffee shops are here. And at the headquarters of the American Hereford Association, there is a giant statue of a bull that sits atop a 90-foot pylon that hovers over downtown and the Kansas City Stock Exchange offices. This is taller than some steeples. In Kansas City, beef is so ingrained in the identity of the place that there's a cut of steak named after the town. When you're growing up in Kansas City in the 1970s and 80s, children were taught then to love and honor God, country, beef, and Royals third baseman George Brett. And not necessarily in that order, depending on how the Royals were doing against the Yankees in the playoffs. At my home, beef was really the norm. Every 3 or 4 months, a truck from a company called Guaranteed Foods would roll up into our driveway, and my mom would fill a basement freezer with steaks, pot roasts, stew meat, and pounds of ground chuck. My mom was a working mom, and on weeknights she often came home too tired to start a meal from scratch, so she'd make things like hamburger helper and tuna helper, utilizing that stuff that was in the freezer downstairs. And on Saturdays, my dad would take over. He'd fire up the backyard grill, and we'd cook steaks, hamburgers, and barbecued ribs, you know, throw in a little pork to mix things up a little bit there. On Sundays, the post-church pot roast with potatoes was as much of a sacred ritual as going to services themselves. When my mom did have the time, she could be a really amazing cook. She loved experimenting with new techniques and new styles of cooking, particularly international cooking. My parents traveled a lot, and she experimented with Japanese and Indian cooking, which was a really a rarity, you think about it at the time, in a suburb of Kansas City that had all the diversity of a loaf of Wonder Bread. She also loved gardening, and we had a nice garden on the side of our house that got really nice southern sun, and you could always find in the summertime there pole beans, sweet corn, tomatoes, and it gets hot in Kansas City, really humid, so we'd find okra, and okra was a wonderful thing to eat. And my mom also made sure that my sister and I, before we left to go out on our own, that she taught us how to cook. She spent a lot of time teaching us basic cooking techniques, and she also spent a lot of time with us in the grocery store teaching us ways to economize and make our food dollars last, and this is something that I'm grateful for to this very day. When I moved out on my own and eventually moved out to Oregon, I ditched those hamburger helper dinners. They were pretty gross. But I continued to eat meat in the great Kansas City tradition. For more than 20 years, I've been writing about food and restaurants in Oregon, and I've discovered an awful lot about this state. I've really gotten to know the farm-to-table connections that a lot of chefs have, and I've gotten to know an awful lot about our farming systems and the difficulties with our industrialized food systems. And yet, in that time, when I would cook at home, I was still a meat and potatoes kind of guy. And animal protein of some sort was part of most of my meals. Then a few years ago, a journalistic opportunity opened my eyes and pointed me towards a new way of eating and thinking about food. I had a chance to interview James McWilliams, who's the author of the controversial book Just Food and is a regular contributor to the Atlantic Monthly. Now, McWilliams has some really interesting ideas that rub the farmers market crowd and locavores the wrong way. For instance, he contends that a tomato that's grown by a local farmer may not have a lower carbon footprint than a tomato that's grown in Southern California and is trucked all the way to your neighborhood Fred Meyer. He also says genetically modified foods may not be the devils they are made out to be, and may actually be a really good thing if they help solve world hunger. And he says that the idea of strictly eating your food from local sources is quaint and even noble, but that it's not particularly realistic if you live in Arizona, or if you live in sub-Saharan Africa, or if you live in Portland, Oregon, and happen to like bananas. But not all of McWilliams' ideas sound so extreme, particularly when it comes to eating meat and the effects that it has on the environment. In our quest to eat more sustainably, McWilliams says that all of our efforts are irrelevant if we don't drastically cut down the amount of meat that we are eating. Livestock accounts for 20% of global warming. It consumes 70% of the water in the American West, and it accounts for the majority of nitrogen fertilizer that's used in developed countries. What's more, the meat industry consumes crazy amounts of fossil fuels, and it uses enormous amounts of the world's arable land that could be used to turned over to plants to feed the hungry. McWilliams says that the world's growing appetite for meat is on a collision course with the rising world population, which is predicted to double by the year 2060. If the world continues to eat meat in the increasingly Western way that it is now, we will need to have 67% more land than we currently have just to keep up with productions. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, it seems the chances are pretty slim that the world is going to sprout another continent that's larger than Africa sometime in the next 39 years. Geological history kind of says this isn't going to happen. So really, we're left with no other conclusion. We have to start eating less meat, or we are going to face drastic environmental consequences. So McWilliams told me that before he began his research, he ate a lot of chicken and pork. He lives in Austin, Texas, and going to the great barbecue houses there was part of his regular routine. But the more and more he learned, the more he thought about what he was doing. And I asked him how he was eating meat then, and what he said was sobering. He had completely given it up because he was unable to reconcile the type of environmentalist that he wanted to be with eating it. And then he challenged me if I was serious about environmental concerns and caring for the earth, I had to take a serious look at the amount of meat that I was consuming. My conversation with James stayed with me a long time and really forced me to confront my own hypocrisy about the way I shopped and ate. I was one of those holier-than-thou sorts who was really excited about curbside recycling and all the newspapers going into the bins and all the bottles getting into the right place. And I was really a zealot about reusable grocery bags, and yet I wasn't paying attention to how green the things were that were going into those green bags. And so I had to ask myself a difficult question. Was I hurting the earth every time I decided to have a steak? About the same time, I attended my very first Veg Fest. Yay, Veg Fest! I was convinced after talking to McWilliams that I wanted to eat less meat, and I was looking for guidance, and I figured Veg Fest would be a great place to learn some tricks and discover some alternatives to eating meat that might appeal to me. And I got here, and the revelations just started cascading. For starters, the people that were at Veg Fest weren't the granola-eating, hemp-wearing crowd that I had assumed they would be. And I was really annoyed with myself when I realized that I had bought into the stereotype of what kind of people vegans might be, when I didn't see all of the tie-dye or the clouds of patchouli. I really got annoyed because, as a gay man, I've spent my entire adult life annoyed with stereotypes that people have about the gay community. And yet, here, I've been guilty of the same ignorance. When I looked around at VegFest, there were people from all walks of life here. There were moms, there were dads, there were kids, there were seniors, there were the hip and trendy, and there were people that dressed like schlubs like me. Ugh, my clothes. And yet, that was only the beginning of what I learned here. I walked around all those aisles, and I saw all the food, and I tasted some really delicious things, things that I'd never tried before, and that was really an eye-opener. And then I started gathering some of the literature that was there that really opened my eyes to some of the things that were going on, particularly with factory farms. And then I listened to the speakers here, and I heard them talk about how they relate food to ideas of compassion and kindness. And that's really what lingered with me the most. These are values that I've always tried to embrace in my life since growing up in the church. Why shouldn't they extend to the way I eat? So I went to my editor at the Oregonian with an idea of eating vegan for a month. and writing about the experience. I figured a month was just about the right amount of time for me to test the waters and see if this was a new way of eating that would work for me. And it also gave me an opt-out date that if what wasn't the right fit, I could go back to doing what I was doing, but hopefully had learned enough things in that time that I could eat less meat. This, of course, isn't an original idea. Lots of journalists over the years have experimented with plant-based eating, and typically 1 month is the period of time that a lot of them have done this experiment. But almost all of those experiments had been approached through a prism of negativity, with the writers looking at all of the things that they couldn't have and really spending a month despairing over their lack of options. I wanted my experiment to be positive and empowering. I wanted to use it to discover all of the things that plant-based eating and living could be and discover how it had an effect in Portland. So I wanted to spend the time exploring vegan Portland, which was something the newspaper hadn't really done. It was a wacky proposal, and I thought it was going to be seen as something pretty esoteric. And to my surprise, my editor said yes. So before embarking on my vegan experiment, I decided I wanted to do homework. And so I grabbed a bunch of cookbooks like Veganomicon and Vegan with a Vengeance that friends had recommended to me as good resources for learning about plant-based eating. I also spent a lot of time at the grocery store the week before I was going to start my experiment, reading labels and kind of getting schooled on all the things I had to look out for, particularly in a natural food store where honey is like all over the place the way high fructose corn syrup is in a conventional grocery store. I wanted to have success from day one, and I really equipped myself with the tools to do that. And then day one came around, and almost immediately, the revelations started happening. Very quickly, because my body wasn't working so hard to digest meat, I found that I was sleeping much, much better. And that was giving me a lot more energy throughout the day, and I wasn't having to rely on my afternoon cup of Starbucks to get me through the afternoon. I also started losing weight, too, which is not the easiest thing to do when you write about food for a living. As the month progressed, I found myself excited by all the fun I was having in the kitchen. I'd known about things like quinoa, tofu, and tempeh, but I'd never really given them a fair shake in the kitchen. And then there were ingredients like soy curls and seitan that I'd never even heard of. They weren't on my radar at all. I was also impressed by all the wonderful food that I found at Portland vegan restaurants, carts, and bakeries. And I was also finding myself increasingly depressed when I went to mainstream options and saw the dismissive way that plant-based dishes were treated there and this horrible lack of creativity that a lot of chefs had when it came to catering to their vegan and vegetarian customers. And they couldn't think of anything more interesting than a plate of grilled vegetables or a pasta primavera. The biggest blessing, it turns out, in this entire month was the tremendous support that I received from people not just here in Portland, but around the world. As I blogged and tweeted about the things I was eating and the things I was discovering, I heard from people from places like Malaysia, South Africa, Australia. I struck up this really interesting Twitter correspondence with a student in Melbourne who every day was checking in on me, seeing, you know, what questions could he answer for me. This is somebody 8,000 miles away. I found that very humbling, and just this tremendous gift that people around the world were giving me. And it also introduced me to a host of people I otherwise wouldn't have known, and it really made all the difference. The month came and the month went, and at the end of it, I felt so good both physically and emotionally that I decided I didn't want to go back. And here's another surprise. Because I'd been writing so much about this and it had drawn such an interesting audience of people, the editors at the paper were perfectly happy to have me continuing writing about the vegan world because it brought readers to our website. And in this day and age, that's something they pay attention to. You know, the news industry is kind of troubled, so they like it when there's new people coming to it. And so the Going Vegan column was born. In just under 2 years, I've had the pleasure to introduce mainstream readers to important voices in the vegan movement, like Bryant Terry, Tal Ronan, Alicia Silverstone, Isa Chandra Moskovitz, and the musician Moby. I've also shared recipes from Portland chefs like Blossoming Lotus's Wes Hanna and Native Bowl's Julie Hassan, as well as dishes from the ever-growing stack of vegan cookbooks that grows and grows every single day on my desk at work. I've had the most fun, though, creating recipes to share with you, like a sauté of black beans with spicy field roast chipotle sausage, a chilled beet soup with tofu, and a bunch of colorful coleslaws made without mayonnaise. Recipes from all the chefs that I've interviewed, plus all those cookbook recipes and the ones I've created, are all available online at OregonLive.com, and I hope you'll look them up, try them out, and that they open doors for you, whether you're new to the idea of plant-based eating or you're a longtime vegan looking for a way to get out of a cooking rut. Having a regularly occurring vegan voice is unusual for a mainstream publication. But in Portland, it makes sense. Author and blogger Eric Marcus calls Portland the vegan capital of the world. And it's easy to see why. Portland is proud of its green stature and how it leads the way on so many environmental fronts. And veganism is a natural fit with that outlook. In addition to all of our vegan restaurants and carts, we have a vegan mini mall, where you can score egg and dairy-free cupcakes, stock up on groceries without having to obsess over all the things that are on the labels. You can pick up a cool t-shirt and even have a tattoo. If you walk up and down Northeast Alberta Street, you can see how vegan and vegetarian eating is becoming commonplace. In the span of about 20 blocks, you'll find a store that sells vegan shoes, several vegan bakeries, a vegan neighborhood bar, largely vegan restaurants, with almost every other eating establishment offering plant-based fare among their menu offerings. And mainstream acceptance in the Portland area is certain to grow even more later this year and early next year when the California-based vegan restaurant chains Native Foods Cafe and Veggie Grill arrive in our market, including Outposts in Tigard and Beaverton. I see evidence of the larger awakening to veganism when I hear from readers. Many of them are vegans who never really felt a connection with the paper in the past because it didn't take veganism seriously. And they are grateful that there's now a place for them in the Oregonian's food coverage. But the vast majority of the people that I hear from are longtime readers and who aren't looking necessarily to embrace plant-based eating 100%, but they're looking to incorporate more vegetarian and vegan meals into their weekly menu routines through things like Meatless Mondays, because they're concerned for their health and they want to do greener things through their eating. While I'm proud of the work that I've accomplished with the Going Vegan column, I'm more proud of the way I've been able to successfully advocate for inclusion of vegan recipes and reviews in our mainstream coverage of Portland food and restaurants. When we write about lasagna, for instance, we offer a rainbow of options to satisfy omnivores, vegetarians, and vegans alike. When we do stories about things like the Super Bowl or tailgate parties, we include vegan recipes among the mix of options. After all, vegans like football too. And vegan restaurants now get treated with respect. Just this past Friday, we had a review of Natural Selection, a new vegetarian and mostly vegan place that probably wouldn't have received a full review in the paper in the past. And in the annual Diner Restaurant Guide that came out last June, Portobello became the first vegan restaurant to crack the elite list of the best restaurants in town. Now, this is not because it's a great vegan restaurant. It's because it's a great restaurant, period. And vegan carts like the Delicious Kitchen Dances and Homegrown Smokers have all received raves in our pages in the last years. I think that including vegan options in mainstream stories and reviews sends an important message to readers who may have dismissed the idea of veganism in the past. When a plant-based recipe sits side by side with more traditional offerings, it helps legitimize this way of eating as deserving something better than the label other. Rather than having vegan coverage sequestered in the back where it could be dismissed as something coming from the wacko fringe, we tell readers that vegan food is worth giving a try no matter what way of eating you choose. Take the baked jambalaya with beans and spicy sausage you'll find in this coming Tuesday's edition of Food Day. It's quick, it's delicious, and it's easy to relate to. It's anything but weird. Of course, there has been criticism of the Oregonian's coverage, particularly from readers of a certain age who say things like, "I've subscribed to the paper since that lovely Mamie Eisenhower was our first lady," which is something a reader once actually said to me. Even though my stories are hardly in your face, including these recipes is seen by some as an act of confrontation. And there are readers who don't like having anyone tell them what they should be eating. It should be said that these are the same readers who long for the good old days when most of the recipes that appeared in the paper involved crock pots and cream of mushroom soup. And those times have long since passed. So the paper's changing, and we hope that the readers' ideas about what can constitute good food change with them. There's plenty of room at the table, and we hope they'll come along. I have also received criticism from people within the tribe. Some veg readers seriously doubt my motives, because I became a vegan at first as a writing stunt, and that my initial motivation was rooted in environmentalism. Now, I believe that how people decide what they're going to eat is a truly complex process. Many people choose vegan because they care about animals, while others are worried about their health or the environment. I'm a combination of all of those things. And I don't believe that one motivation truly trumps another, or that there's a pure reason for considering veganism. Some people have also expressed frustration that I haven't spent much time yet exploring issues like factory farming, animal suffering, the trouble with battery cages, and the growing farm sanctuary movement. Now, these are all important topics, since veganism is about much more than eating. And I do want to address those in the future. But I'm also a food writer who writes for a recipe-driven food section, so I know I have certain limitations with how far I can take the conversation within the confines of those pages, but I do want to find ways to address those. And it's tricky because food is a hot-button issue. Can be. It's like religion or abortion rights. The reason I've taken a less confrontational approach is, frankly, somewhat sneaky. If you can get people in the door, I think, by appealing to their stomachs with satiating food, then I think you can appeal to their hearts and minds. The mission I'm on is still in its infancy, and there will be many opportunities to tell stories about more complex issues regarding veganism in the future, and that's the challenge that's ahead of me. Part of the reason I think we're seeing increasing interest in veganism has to do with a larger veggie moment that's happening in this country. And as people are becoming concerned about the obesity epidemic that we're experiencing, and I think a lot of the credit for the increasing awareness about plants rests with our First Lady Michelle Obama and the way she has used her position of influence to encourage children to eat more vegetables. A lot of credit also goes to high-profile mainstream chefs like Jamie Oliver, Mario Batali, and Jose Andres, who have put greater emphasis on the bounty of the vegetable world. Then there's President Clinton, who has ditched his fast-food-loving ways and has gone high-profile in a big way about his pursuit of plant-based eating and his desire to have better heart health. Turns out, wanting to live long enough to hold your grandbabies really can be an effective way of thinking about how you approach food. And, of course, there's the talk shows. When Oprah, Ellen, Martha, and Dr. Oz all do vegan shows within the span of a couple of months, you know something is going on. But for me, the most gratifying mainstream acceptance of veganism isn't on the talk shows. It's what's been happening with my family, both here and in Kansas City. My wonderful partner, Lee, never really related to the Kansas City aesthetic and the way I used to eat in the past. He's a runner from Eugene, and he always thought that this meat-centric way that I ate was kind of weird. And now he is so accepting and encouraging about the things I'm making, which is good because he tries a lot of the recipes that I'm testing for the paper, and he's very candid in telling me when something doesn't come up to snuff. But he also, when he likes something, I can really tell because he really enjoys eating it. In Kansas City, my sister's family, which has two growing boys, has shifted from a largely vegetarian approach to the dinner table to a mostly vegan way. And right now, my sister, in a show of solidarity with me, is doing Dr. Barnard's 21-day weight loss kickstart with me. I really think that's an awful cool thing for a sister to do. And my youngest nephew, Gage, discovered when I was home last Christmas time, he tried almond milk. He tried to eat vegan while I was there because he wanted to understand it better. And that's not really easy for an 8-year-old to do at Christmas time. But he discovered that he loved almond milk much more than anything that ever came out of a cow. And now that's what he drinks exclusively. The biggest surprise, though, is with my parents, who are 76 years old. They no longer get that freezer full of beef from Guaranteed Foods. And then in the last year, they've shifted to a mostly vegan diet. This happened after I visited them last Christmas time. And my mother had an aha moment while I was there. Before I came home, she had worried about what I would eat while I was there. She asked me, "Do you only eat tofu?" So we had a long conversation about what veganism is and what it isn't. And when I was there, we cooked a number of meals together. And in one of those meals, she had this aha moment. She realized that some of the things that she really loved cooking were vegan. She just had never thought of them this way. For years, she's been making big pots of terrific minestrone soup for church choir parties. And many of those Indian and Japanese dishes she experimented with way back in the 70s were vegan. Again, just happened to be that way. She didn't think of it that way. One day while I was back there, I took my oldest nephew, Nathan, over to Lawrence, Kansas, where we saw a KU basketball game. Go Jayhawks. And we were gone most of the day. And when I got back, my mother had prepared an entirely vegan dinner for the whole family out of a cookbook called The Vegan Table by Colleen Patrick Goudreau. It was a vegan cookbook that I'd brought back because I thought my mom might look at it and realize, okay, this is kind of mainstream the way she approaches it. My mother had made a veggie risotto that was incredible. She'd made a curried green bean side dish that was outstanding. And she made a bundt cake where the key ingredient were bright red beets. That was a little bit weird. Didn't rise quite quick, but it was delicious in taste. The fact that my mother went out of her way to make an entirely vegan meal, not just for me, but for the entire family, was a gift greater than anything under the Christmas tree for me. And I gotta say, everybody loved it. There were no leftovers that night, and it was really gratifying watching my conservative dad gobble down that food and ask for seconds and then thirds. To better understand why veganism is important to me, after the first of the year, my parents started incorporating more plant-based fare into their menus, and now about two-thirds of their meals are vegan. They struggle with breakfast. I don't know that giving up eggs and Jimmy Dean sausage is necessarily going to happen for them, but when you think of people that used to get all of that meat delivered to them, that they're eating two-thirds of their meals vegan, I think that's astonishing. My parents have seen dramatic improvements in their health in just that period of time. My dad's lost 20 pounds effortlessly. My mom has seen improvements in her cholesterol level. And you can tell that my dad's really excited about the food that they're eating because every day he gets on Facebook and types in all capital letters what they had to eat the previous night and how much he's excited that my mom still enjoys exploring new things in the kitchen. You know, my dad has come a long way. And I really, really am grateful to him when I look at the way that he's embracing it because he knew it was something that mattered to me. I think that they're proof that it can have tremendous health benefits. And I would hold them up to people here today who are thinking of eating less meat but haven't necessarily taken the leap. Every meal is an opportunity, I think, to take steps towards a better environment, better health, and compassion for all living beings. Even if you only switch to vegan meals a few days a week, you're making a powerful choice and helping save the world and change the world for the better. Of course, if you want to give up meat entirely and completely embrace veganism, I think you'll be giving yourself a gift that's beyond imagination, and you'll be an inspiration to your friends and loved ones who may follow the guiding light of your actions and words. The great poet and author Maya Angelou calls this being a rainbow in other people's clouds. And she says that our choices in life have the power to open hearts and change the world. I can't improve upon her words, so I'll let her take over. And you'll have to imagine that beautiful, regal voice of hers. I've had rainbows in my clouds. And the thing to do, it seems to me, is to prepare yourself so that you can be a rainbow in somebody else's cloud. Somebody who may not look like you, may not call God the same name you call God, if they call God at all, may not eat the same dishes prepared the way you do, may not dance your dances or speak your language, but be a blessing to somebody. And that's my wish for you. May your life be a blessing to others through your words and deeds. And that's a blessing that can begin with your very next meal. Thank you. Well, we have about 20 minutes, and I'm open to taking all questions about starting with that Veg 101 class, which I'll just proselytize for that a little bit, because I understand there's still some slots available in the series of courses that are opening in the next few weeks. Veg 101 is this enormous gift that Northwest Veg gives to people who are just starting out on the road towards plant-based eating. It's a six-week course that has like this insanely low price. I think it's like $60. Is that right? It's cheap. And you learn so much from it. And when I was first starting out and I was confused about some things, and I had a lot of questions about nutrition and things like B12 and the kind of supplements you might want to be taking, it was a really great, great thing. So if you're thinking about embarking on plant-based eating and you have a lot of questions, it's just a great investment. It's really a wonderful thing. It's called Veg 101, and there's information about it, I believe, on the Northwest Veg homepage. So, a little shout out for that. Questions, please.
I got a question.
Yeah, please.
What's the 21-day diet you referred to?
Okay, this was the hot topic here yesterday. The 21-day weight loss kickstart is a program that's developed by Dr. Neil Barnard. He's the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and he actually spoke here yesterday. And this is a plan that he created for people who aren't vegans but are looking to reduce their weight to fight obesity. It's really pretty simple. You adopt a plant-based diet, and you dramatically limit your use of oils. And the reason I went on it, even though I was doing the vegan thing, was after initially losing weight when I started out from, not eating all that saturated fat that was all that beef I was consuming, I lost a lot of weight initially, but I kind of hit a plateau. And so I was looking for, a way that made sense for me to kind of kickstart and start, losing a little more weight, because, what I do for a living is crazy. We eat all the time, and we're constantly testing recipes. And a lot of those recipes, while they may be vegan, they're not necessarily healthy. They may have a lot of oil in them. So I read Dr. Barnard's book, and I knew he was coming here, and I thought, oh, that might be somebody interesting to talk to in advance of this festival to, get people to come through and give this festival a larger look. And it's really been a pretty interesting experience. I've been on it 2 weeks now, and I've lost 7 pounds, which is pretty amazing. And it's insane amounts of food you get to eat, and you're just really watching the way you limit oils. The biggest shift for me was, while I ate lots of really healthy food, I tended to have not-so-healthy snacking habits, a tortilla chip vegan. And so I've been adjusting to eating more apples and crunchy things like that to get that kind of that satisfying crunch. So, but it's a really interesting book. I don't know if they have any more copies, but they had a bunch of copies of them at the book table yesterday. And it's worth just looking at. They also have
I think that the website is, let's see, PCRM.org, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. If you go to PCRM.org, you can find out more on there. They have a lot of recipes, so you don't even have to buy a book to find out more about it. Yeah?
Is it just the actual oils that you can't have, or can you have nuts and avocados and all that?
He recommends limiting those things during the 21-day period. It's like, you know, you can do anything for 21 days. Like, you know, I could go vegan for a month. I figured it's not that hard. Okay, this other guy couldn't do it for 2 weeks, but I don't think his heart was in the right place. But yeah, for this thing, it's a 21-day experience, and I figure I can limit that stuff for 21 days and then see, take stock, see where it's at. Yeah?
Could a master vegan program, how much is that? And is there prerequisite for it?
I don't know what the answer is to that. I just took the vegetable. Peter could perhaps.
It's $10.55, and there's no prerequisite.
Okay.
Could you tell us a little more about the restaurant that's coming to Tigard and Beaverton that you mentioned?
Yeah, there's two. The first is called Native Foods Cafe, and it's going to be in Bridgeport Village. How mainstream is that? It's going to be right in the center of Bridgeport Village. There's this space that was a restaurant called Zao Noodle Bar that's like right across the street from Tommy Bahama. And this burger place, that burger kiosk. So you're going to get this vegan place right next to this burger kiosk, which I think is kind of cool. They're coming in. It's worth giving their menu a look. It looks really interesting to me. I haven't had any of their food, and I can't tell you a lot about it. Veggie Grill, I know a lot of people in Southern California, that's one of their favorite places to eat. And that's coming later, probably in the first quarter of next year, and they've announced locations in downtown Portland and in Beaverton. And again, the menus are online. Take a look at them. They sound really interesting. And the fact that we're going to get these all-vegan chains, that's a big step, I think. And it's interesting, like Native Foods Cafe, they have a big presence in Southern California and Chicago. And so Portland is like the third market that they've gone into. So again, I think it's a sign of Portland's role in the vegan world, and that they're choosing to come here before going to Seattle or San Francisco. I think that says a lot about what's going on in this city right now. Yes?
What was the name of the cookbook you said you left with your mother?
It was called The Vegan Table, and the person who wrote it, her name is Colleen Patrick Goudreau, and this lady is a cookbook writing machine. I think she's had five cookbooks come out in the last 2.5 years, and they've embraced a wide variety of topics. She had a book called Color Me Vegan, which explores the whole rainbow diet about how you should be eating a wide variety of differently colored foods to help optimize your health. The Vegan Table is her book that's about family holiday celebrations. That's the reason I took it home at Christmas time, because she had all these really interesting menu ideas for how you can make a really festive table for Thanksgiving, Christmas, big anniversaries, birthdays ending in zeros that didn't have meat on them, but that would make people that were there feel like they were really being embraced and loved. And when I talked to Colleen, that was almost 2 years ago that I talked to her, she had really beautiful things to say about how she approached cooking as an expression of joy. And I hadn't really thought a lot about that. And in the time since then, I've heard other people say similar things. Bryant Terry is this really amazing African-American chef who is trying to take back American soul cooking from this idea that it has to be loaded with ham hocks and all of these things that are really unhealthy. And one of the things that he does in his cookbook, which is called The Vegan Soul Kitchen, that is to me just such a pure expression of joy, is he incorporates song selections for every single recipe he has. So he has a dish for a pot of greens that maybe was inspired by a song by Lena Horne that he really loved. And then there's another song from Wu-Tang Clan that inspired a pot of beans. And he encourages you to like get on iTunes and download playlists to come up with your own sound system, because he learned from his grandmother that cooking is like this all-sensory experience. And his grandmother, when she was cooking in the kitchen when he was growing up in the South, she would sing gospel hymns and she would sing beautiful American popular songs while she was cooking. And forever after, when Bryant would taste a type of cornbread, he would associate it with a gospel melody. And I just can't think of anything like that that really relates the joy that comes with cooking really good food for people that you care about. So, yeah, Colleen Patrick-Goudreau and Brian Terry, they're really worth checking out.
Thank you.
Yeah, back into that.
Yeah, can you talk about the impact that your transformation has had at the Oregonian, among other staff, if any?
Well, you know, for years and years and years, I've written about arts at the paper. But I've never been seen as the arts guy. I was always the gay guy that you go to with questions about, you know, is this story sensitive towards the gay community? And now I'm the vegan guy. So it's like, okay, why am I never the arts guy? Because that's what that was my bread and butter. But anyway, it's definitely been, the reception has been really positive in the newsroom because people respond to it. And you know, we hear so many negative things, and you know, I don't know if you've ever gone on the Oregonian's website and looked at all of like the horrible comments that get put on there about, you know, the president's birth certificate and the whole awful Kyron Horman story. You know, it's just can be a cesspool of negativity. And the stories that I write get this positive energy going. There's detractors that are going to be on, that get on there. There's always the trolls that can't resist getting on and saying, you know, PETA stands for people eating tasty animals. And it's like, okay, you know, go start your own blog, really, if you need to bring negativity into mine. But the newsroom has really been very positive about it. It's funny, though, the top editor at the paper, his name is Peter Bhatia, and his family's ancestry is from India. His father came over here from India. He's first-generation American. And he's like, I don't get all this vegan stuff you're writing about. And I'm like, dude, 50% of the stuff I'm cooking comes from your heritage. And it's like, and he's like, oh, now that you think about it, I hadn't thought about that. So it's kind of, again, on a day-to-day basis, getting people to think about it. It may not be so strange as you think it may be. Yeah.
Back in the 70s, I read a book about macrobiotics, and that's kind of like the far left wing of veganism. And I was wondering if you had touched on, you know, reading anything about that.
You know, I've touched just a little bit on the health and nutrition angles of this, and I've largely stayed away from it because I'm not a nutritionist, and I'm learning things as we go along. And I'm trying to share what I learn as we go along, but I don't really, like, I get calls from people wanting to say, why haven't I done the definitive story on B12? And it's like, well, I don't know a lot about that. And I want to do that story at some point, but I need to do a lot more schooling before I can speak with any level of authority on that. You know, I've got authority on what tastes good, but in terms of, you know, writing about things like the other one that I get a lot is anytime you mention anything related to soy, people want you to write something about, you know, how it affects estrogen levels in women. Well, I want to approach that at some point, but I don't have any expertise in that area. So it's, you know, it's kind of writing about the things that I do know about and presenting them in a way that I can get people to think about them. And I do want to get to those things, but I've got to learn about those things myself.
Well, these are actually recipes. These are the form, you know, of veganism.
Okay. Yeah.
What are some of your favorite vegan foods?
Well, I love Indian cuisine and Mexican cuisine. And, you know, I was talking with a friend recently. She was saying, well, what do you like to eat in your kitchen? I said, well, gosh, you know, we go through lots of garbanzos and black beans in my kitchen because I love to use those as a protein base for a lot of different foods. I love really spicy foods, so I'm pretty heavy-handed with the pepper. Hot peppers, sometimes too heavy-handed, I'm told. But I like it, you know, and there's this thing that I do when I'm eating food. For some reason, really spicy food makes the top of my scalp sweat. And you know, why not my brow? Why is it up here? And so I'll be eating, you know, a dish of some curried something or another that I've made, and I'll go, yeah, this is good food. So, yeah.
Do you have any favorite
You know, it's surprising. I thought in that first month that that would be the thing that, because I'd read all these other kind of negative things where people talking about, oh, how can I live without bacon and all this, you know, doing without cheese? It's driving me crazy. So I'd read all those things, and I was expecting to have some of that. And the reason I don't think I had that was because I was exploring the bulk food bins and finding all these really interesting ingredients, ancient grains and unusual kinds of legumes that I'd never used before. And so I was really expanding my range of what I could do in the kitchen, and it was so not boring that I didn't have time to sit around longing for the things that I'd used to be eating. And I think that was a real key for me to success, was that I pushed myself and I didn't allow myself to kind of do the really, oh, there's this really boring approach to vegan cooking that a lot of mainstream chefs do, and it drives me up the wall. It's this idea where they take a regular item that they might have on their menu, they delete the meat and replace it with tofu. And, you know, it's like, tofu piccata, really? You know, do who really wants to have that? You know, and that's one of the things, I actually used that joke in that review of Natural Selection last week, because to me, the chef at Natural Selection, this guy Aaron Wu, really gets that's not the right way to make really exciting and inventive vegan and vegetarian meals. This is a guy that has his roots in mainstream kitchens, but he approaches plant-based protein as a building block towards doing really creative, really extravagant, really beautiful dishes. And at no point do you see a block of tempeh or tofu in sight. I'm not dismissing those ingredients. I'm just saying I find that approach that a lot of mainstream chefs have is really uncreative. And I guess that's one of the things that I would love to challenge you all as you are going out to restaurants in Portland. First, we have great vegan restaurants here in Portland, and I hope you support them. And this place, Natural Selection, is really a wonderful addition to our dining scene. And Portland doesn't have a really great history of supporting vegan and vegetarian fine dining. We love the little neighborhood places where we can go and have a great meal and not spend $50. But we don't have a great history of supporting the place where you might go if you got the promotion or if it was like the hot date night, you know. So I hope people will support this place because it's really a great addition to our scene. And I hope that when you're going to Portland's vegan restaurants, when you have bad food there, I hope you'll call them out on it because they need to hear it. I think that bad vegan food does a really disservice to the movement at large. You know, when people go to a Mexican restaurant and they have bad food, they don't think, oh, all Mexican food is terrible. They say, okay, that was a bad place. Let's go to the next Mexican place. But when people are new to plant-based eating and they go someplace and they get this overcooked, bland galop in a pot, which is what some places serve, they're going to think this is what this kind of eating is all about. And these places need to know that they can do better, and they need to hear it from their customers. Because, and it may not be easy for them to hear, and it may not be easy for you to say, but it takes us to the next plane, and it furthers, I think, the important work that can be done in our restaurants of introducing people in the mainstream to this way of eating as being viable, even if people only want to do it a couple of days a week. Because I'm not an either-or kind of guy. I think if people choose to do a little bit more, that's better than what they were doing before. And then the other thing I would love to challenge you all to do is keep going to mainstream restaurants. We love our vegan restaurants, but we shouldn't patronize them only, because I think it's important for mainstream restaurants to know that they have vegetarian and vegan customers who demand more from them than tofu piccata. And I think that it's really important that you give them a call before you go, make your reservation, and say, hey, I'm vegan, I'm coming. What can you do for me that's not a grilled portobello mushroom? And I think what you'll find is that at most restaurants, I mean, there's some restaurants like Higgins where he routinely has a lot of interesting vegetarian and vegan options among them because he's interested in that food and because he loves farmers and he knows that farmers make great produce and he wants produce to be the star of a lot of what he does. But then there's other restaurants where you'll look at their menu online and there's not a single vegan option on the menu at all, even a salad, because they'll put butter in the croutons. And those are the places that you need to call and say, what can you do for me? And my experience is that frequently there is a line cook at that restaurant who is a vegetarian or a vegan, and they are excited that someone, one of their people is coming to the restaurant, and that person will get to cook something unique for you. And it will be the envy of everybody else at your table. It'll be the most exciting dish that anybody has. It'll be fresher and more exciting. And people are going to want to eat your dinner. And you're like, mitts off of my food. So I encourage you to do that because I think it's really important for mainstream chefs to get that message. So a little bit there. Yes?
Kind of a change of pace. You have a little different perspective. Imagine us 10 years from now. 2021.
Well, gosh, given that seven years ago there were like 300 people that turned up, and the way it's grown, maybe it'll take up this entire. They'll have to boot race to the cure to the other side of the convention center. You know, maybe by in that time, who knows? I think that you're going to see it continue to boom. Because I think that people are thinking about it more as a viable option, even if it's not 100%. And, you know, again, I look at my parents, and I look at the way that they've discovered that this is a really good food, that it's not this strange way of eating that they kind of thought about it in the past. Again, my mom thought all I ate was tofu. And now that they cook it all the time, I think if they can do it in Kansas City, it's going to just take off in a place like Portland and places like Seattle and Vancouver, BC. I think it's just going to explode in places like that because if it can work in Kansas City, it can work all kinds of places. And I think it'll also be interesting to see what happens with these national chains if they really do get inroads. The other thing that's been kind of fun to see with my father is a couple of months ago, Kansas City got their first Trader Joe's. And he had known that from something that I had written that Trader Joe's goes out of their way to mark products as being vegan friendly. And he was thrilled because they'd shop Trader Joe's, but they had to like drive to St. Louis to get stuff from it. And that's a long drive across a hot, sweaty state to go get some things that you really like. So like the week that Trader Joe's open, my dad got on Facebook, and it's all capital letters, and he said, I'm so excited that Trader Joe's is opening this week, but I'm not one of those crazy people that's down there camping right now. I'm going to wait and go down at 6 a.m. on Friday morning, the day they open. So he went down at 6 a.m. in the morning, the day Trader Joe's opened, so that he could be part of that initial wave going through there. And at least once a week, he's on there and saying, Here's what we had tonight. It was based on a Trader Joe's vegan products we found. And I think that, you know, as Trader Joe's expands throughout the country, I think that's going to make it a lot easier for a lot of people. So, yeah, back in the back.
I was wondering if you have a list of your dad's favorite recipes. Yeah, when I asked my mom,
well, I don't have a list, but that's a great idea. And that's a story I should write because it's really interesting, you know, that when people were so used to eating meat as I was, that it could be a bit of a transition. And for someone like my dad, yeah, I should find out what are the things like his top 10. Maybe that would be a good online list to compile. The top 10 recipes my dad likes. I like that idea. Thanks for that. Yeah?
Have you ever, or would you consider doing a story on some of the
local vegetable options, such as I'm trying to learn more about CSAs, you know, and stuff like that?
Yeah, we do quite a bit of that already in our Food Day section. We have a page in our Food Day section that's called Small Bites. And this is kind of a little short page of snippets of, you know, cookbooks we like, TV shows we're watching. But we also have, like, this week's Farmer's Market pick. It's like what's in season, what's really fresh right now, and what you can do with it. So we do that every week, and it's available online. If you don't get the paper, you can find it. Again, that's OregonLive.com/foodday. And it's in there. It goes live every Tuesday morning, and you can look for that. It's in a feature. It's called Small Bites.
Yeah. How would you handle the social part of your evolution? I'm in an evolution right now, and I'm nervous about becoming the person that nobody wants to invite over for dinner because I'm difficult, you know, and everybody's afraid. I mean, I'm already a foodie. I came from the restaurant business. They're already... don't like to feed me. Now what are they going to do?
I'd recommend a preemptive strike and invite them over. No, invite them over to your place and show them a wonderful meal that you've prepared that happens to be vegan. Show them how exciting it can be. Show them what a good cook you are. Show them this wide range of things and really, you know, bust them out of their preconceived notions about what this can be. Now, then when you do get invited to a party, tell the host, you know, what can I do to help? Can I bring something? This is a way that you can make sure that you have something, you know, to eat while you're there that's really delicious. But it also is a way that you can spread the message about, here's this dish, this wonderful dish. You can treat it as a side dish. You can treat it as an entree, however you want to do it. But it's delicious. It's wonderful. It's nutritious. And it happens to be vegan. I think that that's a wonderful thing to do. The other thing that... if someone invited you to a party, if you volunteer to bring something, they may say, oh, no, we'll take care of you, not a problem. But you've signaled to them that this is something important to you, and you've actually done them a really big favor, a much bigger favor than if you don't tell them that you, you know, are vegan or you have, you know, gluten intolerance or whatever. By letting them know in this non-confrontational way, that, you know, and offering to help them, you've alerted them to this, and they'll probably go out of their way to do something special for you. And again, that's a process that can be wonderful for them. If they're not used to eating that way or cooking that way, they can discover something new themselves as a cook. Yes?
Outside of your own home, where would you say you've had the most remarkable vegan meal in the Portland area?
Wow. There have been some really good ones. There's two answers to that. There's the restaurant approach and there's the cart answer. I love Portobello Vegan Trattoria. I think it's just a phenomenally awesome restaurant. It's, you know, this Brooklyn approach to Italian cooking. They just, you know, they need the red checkered tablecloths to make the whole deal complete. They have a wood-fired oven. They do really wonderful pizzas and things out of there. And I've gone there a number of times, and, you know, we'll order a couple of appetizers, a couple of entrees, maybe share a dessert, have a couple of glasses of wine. And you're hard-pressed to spend $50 there. It's such good food, and it's such a good value. It's on Southeast 12th and Division. They have a good website, Portobello Vegan Trattoria. And Aaron Adams, who's the chef there, is just this smart guy, and he really gets food. And really understands about, you know, taking something like Italian food that really speaks to a lot of people's hearts and cooking it in a way that's different without all the cheese and without all, you know, the meat-laden sauces, but creating dishes that are just, you know, really evoke that Italian Americana. And, you know, you almost think, you know, is Mama back there watching over the Sunday gravy all afternoon while you know, the kitchen is cooking? It's that kind of food. It really speaks to your heart. In the cart world, there's this wonderful cart called Kitchen Dances, which is part of this Southeast Belmont food cart called Good Food Here. And the chef there is this guy named Piper Dixon. And he was the chef, I became a fan of his when he was the chef up at Proper Eats, which is a restaurant in North Portland in the St. John's area. And that was one of the places that I discovered really, you know, how creative early on vegan cooking could be, because it treated these ingredients with such respect. And Piper's Cart, kind of, you have to go there a bunch of times because you can experience it a lot of different ways. He has raw dishes that he does. He has dishes that are kind of from the Tex-Mex idiom. And then he has these dishes that are kind of unlike anything you've ever seen before, and they're all really delicious, and the executions can be either really complex or really simple. And the guy's got goods. I was lucky enough to be asked to be one of the judges this past summer at the Vegan Iron Chef competition, and this guy won it, and his cooking was really creative and just really impressive, a really interesting guy. And again, that's another place you can go and have a really great food experience and not spend much money. I think a lot of his dishes are like between $4 and $7. Do you know where Movie Madness is on Belmont? It's this pod of carts that's directly to the west of there. If you can find Movie Madness, you'll find it. It's there. It's really a nice food cart pod. They've got landscaping and picnic tables. It's not like, you know, carts on a dirty parking lot. It's a really nice, if you're looking for a nice food cart experience, that's the place to go to have it. Oh.
Talk about creative cooking.
Yeah.
You get sampled 50 of them in a row.
Yes.
Any vegan Sunday brunch places?
You know, I don't get to do Sunday brunch hardly ever. I volunteer at an AIDS hospice on Sundays, and that's kind of my ministry. And so I spend Sundays cooking for people there, and I don't really go out to Sunday brunch. And I've got to admit that breakfast is like my least favorite meal of the day. It always has been. And when I go around town and I see people who are, you know, standing outside restaurants for 2 hours to have breakfast, I don't get it. It's like, I can make that at home. And so, and it's actually on this 21-day kickstart, it's the thing I like struggle because I have to force myself to eat something. And I just, you know, it's like oatmeal. I don't like it. It's like, ugh. You know, and so that's a challenge for me. So I don't have great vegan brunch recommendations, but I'm sure you can ask around here. There are people who love breakfast a lot more than I do who will have some tips for you.
Got the Sweet Pea Baking. They have a all you can eat Sunday brunch for $10, including coffee. That's a 12th start, and also Blossoming Lotus has a more upscale vegan brunch on Sundays.
Thank you for that.
Starts at 10 a.m.
Okay. Well, I'll wrap this up. I know they got to get a movie started in here in just 15 minutes. Thank you all. I have some business cards down here if you want to come and get my email address. I'd love to talk with you through email. And also, I do the Twitter thing. If you want to engage with me on Twitter, you can find me at @GrantButler.
You have been an inspiration. Really.
Thanks.
To struggle with. Nice to see it. Thank you.